Welcome to the New Zealand Motoring Podcast, brought to you by podcasts.co.nz.
Welcome to the New Zealand Motoring Podcast. This is our special 8th episode. This is a V8 episode. See the whole 8 and V8 thing there that we're doing there, David?
Who are you? Are you going to introduce yourself?
I'll get there eventually. I'm Damien O'Carroll, of course.
And I'm David Linklater.
And we've decided to go with the 8 theme for the 8th podcast simply because, well, why not? We're a bit of a fan of the V8.
Because we like V8.
We like V8s. Everyone likes V8s. Let's face it, V8s are awesome. And there seems to have been a remarkable amount of them coming out just recently.
There has. Part of the inspiration was we each found that we'd been driving a lot of V8 vehicles this year. And given that V8s are supposed to be dying and everyone's downsizing, we thought that was quite surprising. So we thought it would be worth having a chat about a few of the V8s we've been driving. We're actually doing another one of our mobile podcasts, and we're actually in quite a special V8 vehicle as we roll. And we're just coming through a tunnel. That's really childish.
That was very childish. But
so, I mean, one of the big questions is why a V8's so appealing, and we may have just answered that question.
I think so. This has quite a lot to do with that. That particular question.
It's so older gentlemen like ourselves can just be childish.
Absolutely.
We're not going to tell you what the vehicle we are driving is until the end. You've heard the noise. You've probably got a picture in your mind of what sort of vehicle it is. You're probably wrong, actually. It's quite a surprising car.
Right.
It's a pretty special car, but we'll talk about that right at the end. Let's just get started on some of our cars.
We're giving away the whole news thing. We're going for a different format again. So,
and we probably should say, excuse the occasional rumble. We are driving. It's a very loud car we're in.
It's extraordinarily loud
car. It's part of the pleasure. So you're going to hear the odd rumble and gear change and what have you. So just bear with us. We're enjoying ourselves. I hope you are too.
Absolutely.
So we've sort of divvied up our V8s into subgroups, haven't we?
Yeah.
We're quite organised.
Yeah. Surprisingly organised. The first group, I suppose, is the sort of the classic V8 group, really. The muscle car.
Muscle cars,
the
yeah.
The muscle car.
And for us in this part of the world, I suppose, it's Aussie muscle cars that are really
important. They're the most common one.
Yeah.
And of course, just lately, we've seen a refreshed version of the Holden Commodore SS.
Not just an SS, though, is it?
No.
It's an SSV Redline.
The Redline, absolutely. And the one I had was a remarkable shade of green, in fact.
It was a remarkable shade of wagon as well.
It was very waggony and very green.
It was a little bit out of character for an Aussie V8 muscle car to be a wagon, but there you go.
Wasn't it? But this thing was quite the muscle car. Of course, the SSV Redline is sort of the top of the performance tree for the Commodore until you move up into HSVs.
It is, and we've actually we've talked about it already just a little bit because it was actually in my dream garage last podcast.
It was, yes.
I think I chose a sedan, actually.
Yes.
So I was just being conventional.
You were, But I think, I personally prefer the wagon. I think the wagon shape is
the sport wagon's a good shape, yeah.
Yeah. So $76,990 for the SSV Redline.
That's a lot of money for a Commodore, isn't it?
A lot of money for a Commodore.
Is it worth it, though?
Yes and no.
I'll just say yes.
You'll say yes. I'll say yes and no. It depends what you sort of compare it to, but I think, you know, you get the 6-litre V8, 260 kilowatts, 570 newton metres. It's a fantastic engine.
That's actually quite a bit less than the car we're driving now,
it's
I must
considerably
say.
Considerably less, yes. Yeah. But the car we're driving now is mental.
I'll tell you why I think it's worth the money. Because they made the Redline, there is just a standard SSV,
yes.
But they made the Redline as kind of a track special. It was the ultimate expression of the Commodore V8. It's been really thoroughly developed. It's got different steering calibration. It's got a performance setting for the stability control, so you can take it on the track and do skids without switching the traction control off completely. It's got different suspension. It's just a really thoroughly developed package, and
absolutely.
It is absolutely fantastic to drive. It's quite a sophisticated car, actually.
It is.
It's got the big brakes.
Very big brakes. I agree with you on all of that, but then I counter that by saying, are you really going to take a station wagon onto the track?
Yeah. We've already discussed that the sedan is the one. That's the one in my dream garage.
Fair enough.
Yes, I am going to take that on the track.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'll tell you what, there's only one thing wrong with the car. I absolutely love that car, and there's only one thing wrong with it, and that's that it does not sound like a V8.
It does not sound like a V8 in the slightest. It's far, far too quiet, and what noise it does make is quite unlike that.
It could almost be mistaken for a 6, actually.
It could, inside the car, especially. Yes,
apart from the performance, obviously.
Clearly, which is fairly decent.
But, I mean, the great battle is always Holden versus Ford, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So what have Ford got to offer?
Well, I suspect the reason for the sort of reappearance of the refreshed red line on the press fleet had something to do with the launch of the Falcon XR8.
Yeah, which is a car we've been hearing a lot about. It's kind of the last hurrah for the Falcon, isn't it?
Very much so.
Both Falcon and Commodore obviously are on limited time now. They're both finishing in 2017. I think it's 2017 for the Commodore, 2016 for the Falcon, is that right?
I think something like that. Yeah, there is slightly different dates for them, but neither have got much time left in this world. Where the Commodore's going out on a technologically high point.
Where are you going with this?
Yeah, the Falcon isn't particularly going that direction.
I'm relying on you for this because I actually haven't driven the XR8 yet.
No, well,
difficult getting a drive in one.
We did have to fight to get it, and not because they didn't want to give it to us, just because you get the overwhelming feeling that Ford aren't all that interested in the Falcon XR8.
Ford New Zealand lost interest in the Falcon many years ago. Obviously, they don't have that same passion about selling the cars because we're just an export market for the car, basically. Where they don't make them here, obviously. It's an Australian product. So, that's quite not pursued quite as passionately by Ford New Zealand. And I think that's reflected in the sales figures.
Absolutely.
it's basically ground to a halt.
Yeah. But I do believe there has been something of a resurgence with the new FGX, as it is called, particularly the XR8.
Terrible name.
It's a terrible name. But anyway.
But on paper, the appeal of the XR8, the new one, is that it's basically a cheap FPV, isn't it?
Exactly, yes. It's a very cheap FPV.
The reason why they can do a cheap FPV is because FPV's dead.
Exactly.
It's gone.
And they had all these FPV bits left over that they had to do something with, so they decided, let's make the XR8 mental. And, I mean, it's got the FPV's supercharged engine.
So how much power is that?
That is 335 kilowatts.
So that makes the Commodore look a bit sad, doesn't it?
Makes the Commodore look very sad. And the sound it makes shows the Commodore exactly what you can do with noise out of a V8.
I have heard it from outside, and it does sound great.
It's fantastic. I mean, from the inside, of course, too, you get the supercharger whine laid over top of it. It's just a brutally fast car, but it's...
Speaking as someone who hasn't driven it, you know what the problem with it is?
What's that?
It looks so old-fashioned.
It does look
It could be a Falcon from 20 years ago.
Well, it pretty much is, to be honest, let's face it. But the Falcon hasn't had a hell of a lot done to it in 20 years. But the fact is, it's got a kind of a strange, old-school muscle car charm to it.
Which is good.
It actually is just an appealing old... The brakes are huge and they're really heavy. The steering's quite light, like Falcons always are, but...
So it's quite a different approach, isn't it?
It's totally different.
Holden's made the Commodore a really sophisticated performance car, almost like a European-style performance car that you can take to the track and it feels great and it does everything right. The Falcon is just a big muscle car that sounds loud and you do skids in.
Big, low-tech, fast... Sounds fantastic. Actually handles surprisingly well, too. I took it out for a bit of a thrash on a windy back road this morning. And, but then the FG's always been fairly decent at handling.
Yeah, Falcon's always been a good handler. If listeners are wondering why things have gone awfully quiet, it's because we're stuck in a traffic jam at a roundabout, which just shows that even owning a very exclusive and expensive and powerful V8 doesn't exclude you from being stuck in the world's worst traffic jam.
You can express your displeasure quite loudly, though.
I think I can see the needle moving as well on the fuel gauge.
Yes.
There we go, we're moving again.
There we go.
So how much is the Falcon?
The Falcon is $69,990.
It's quite a bit cheaper than the Holden. Not that we're doing a comparison.
No, we're not.
You can't help but compare them.
In fact, it's probably, at this stage in both of their respective lives, they are probably the most different they've ever been. Really.
Yeah, absolutely, because they've always been nose to nose. It's always been tit for tat. One company does something, the other one does something exactly the same to match it.
Yep.
They've gone in somewhat different directions, so it's quite interesting.
Extremely, it is.
Yeah, I'm actually looking forward to driving the Falcon. I think, you know, just the noise of it's great.
Yeah, it is. It's fun in a very sort of, like I say, primitive old school muscle car kind of way.
And but speaking of old school and muscle, you have actually driven something that makes them both look a little bit anemic.
I have.
You?
We've been teasing this for quite some time now.
I know,
like talking about it.
Well, now's your chance.
And it's really probably the ultimate muscle car.
If you like that sort of thing.
And I do like that sort of thing, to be honest.
I know you do. I was just just setting you up for that.
Absolutely. And thank you for the setup. Now, this is essentially what, I mean, it's been called the ultimate muscle car. It's the most powerful muscle car ever made in the United States. It is, of course, the Dodge Challenger Hellcat.
That's saying something, isn't it? The most powerful muscle car from the United States. Because, I mean, muscle cars in the US are basically all about straight line speed. There's no... Traditionally, no finesse to them whatsoever. No. As long as they go fast.
As long as it goes fast, straight it doesn't line. Matter if it goes around a corner or if it looks good.
No, they don't really have corners in America.
No, that's true. Yeah. That's true. But no, this thing, I had it for an entire day. I was lucky enough to drive it from San Jose to San Francisco.
How far is that?
Not that long. It's about an hour and a half. But if you go...
So how many petrol stations are on the way from A to B? Because you would have needed them.
Well, surprisingly enough, I actually didn't. But then there was a reason for this, and it was absolutely hosing down with rain the whole time.
Perfect conditions.
It. Absolutely. The Hellcat, of course, is another supercharged V8. It produces 527 kilowatts of power.
That's quite a lot.
And 880 newton metres of torque.
That's actually quite a bit more than the car we're driving. That's quite a bit more than any vehicle on Earth, really.
It's quite a lot indeed, yeah.
I can't think of many cars that produce that much power.
And there is actually interweb-based proof by various outlets in the States.
Those two things don't really go together. Internet and proof.
I know. No, video proof then, put it that way.
Yes.
I think it was Road and Track or Car and Driver, one of those American magazines with an and in the middle.
Yes.
Took a Hellcat to put it on a dyno, in fact, and found that those numbers were considerably less than what it was actually producing.
Is that just because it's antisocial to say it's got 1,000 newton meters?
It's odd that a manufacturer would claim less, but I think so.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Oh, they're being conservative. The Europeans are good at that. They're always quite conservative with their figures, aren't they?
Absolutely. The Koreans, not so much.
So what was it actually like to drive? It's enough talking about figures. Who cares? Exactly. You want to know what it's like to drive a vehicle like that.
It was fantastic.
Is that the end of your assessment?
Yeah, that's it. That was fantastic. No, it was an absolutely amazing car.
How many times did you feel frightened?
Only sort of initially. When I started off in it, I felt slightly intimidated because it was extraordinarily wet and it was extremely powerful. By about the second time I got it sideways, inadvertently, I realised it was just incredibly easy to do that.
So when you say you got it sideways inadvertently, presumably all the electronic driver assistance system stepped in and saved you.
Yes.
And that's the difference, isn't it, between the modern muscle car and the ones from 20 or 30 years ago.
Yep.
I can remember driving, you know, V8 Commodores and Falcons and things 20 years ago, and they were genuinely scary because there was nothing to save you.
Exactly. This thing, I mean, this is pretty much, you know, like I say, the ultimate modern muscle car, and it will just, in the wet, light up its tyres at almost any speed, quite frankly. Out on the freeway doing 100 kilometres an hour, nail the throttle.
Yeah.
It's lighting up the tyres. It's trying to snap sideways.
So, quite antisocial, really.
Extremely
antisocial.
Which
is really the point of a muscle car, isn't it?
Absolutely. No point in it, apart from making lots of noise, going really fast and going sideways.
Does it look good?
It looks fantastic. The one I was really disappointed when it turned up. I was hoping for one of a bright green one or a bright orange one or something. And this one turns up in almost a gunmetal sort of dull grey.
Oh, that's all right. I would have liked a white one. Then I could pretend I was at Vanishing Point.
That would have been quite cool. But it had black wheels and it's got a black matte black bonnet and it looks insane.
Yeah.
It makes an incredible noise. It's noisier than the thing we're in now.
Yeah. That's an achievement.
That is an achievement. Supercharger whine over top of everything. It's just absolutely remarkable. But the most amazing thing was, despite the fact it was absolutely soaking wet, like I say, you touch the throttle, it lights up the wheels, it tries to go sideways. It was really easy to control.
Yeah.
Staggeringly easy to control. And you kind of got the feeling, I can't say I was brave enough to test this, but you kind of got the feeling that even without all the electronics saving you, it still would have been easy to control.
Yeah.
I didn't want to find that out, though.
Is there any suggestion that any of these cars are going to make it to our fair land?
Well, there was comment a while ago that Fiat Chrysler were looking at bringing a few Hellcats in under the low volume importation.
So they would be left-hand drive cars.
They would be left-hand drive cars, So there is a chance. I mean, it's...
Do we have any idea how much they would cost?
Well, as we said in our last podcast, there are a few private imports floating around through dealers and so on for $140,000.
Yeah.
It retails for, I think it was about $60,000 in the States, which would be about $80,000 New Zealand. So you'd probably expect an official one to be around the $100,000 mark, maybe?
$100,000. That's actually not bad value
it's
when you look at the Aussie
at
cars.
Absolutely.
When you're talking, when you're in the days of a $76,000 Commodore...
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you look at, you're in the days of a $100,000 HSV.
Yeah, exactly.
And this,
well, more, actually.
Yeah.
More.
Yeah. This thing would just destroy an HSV.
All right. So that's, I mean, that's probably the ultimate expression of an American muscle coupe, isn't it? But another one of the cars we're going to talk about is Japan's ultimate expression of a muscle coupe.
Japan has always been a V8 country. They've always done V8s.
They have.
But in a slightly different way, really.
This Lexus is doing V8s in the old school way, actually. It's, we've talked a bit in past podcasts about the F brand, which is sort of Lexus's equivalent to AMG and BMW M and Audi RS. And they are very committed to V8s. And the RCF Coupe, which is, I think, a car we've talked about on previous podcasts, actually, that's another one that's been doing the rounds. And it's quite an old-school V8 in some respects.
Well, very much so. It is. I don't want to sort of insult Lexus engineers and say it's low-tech, but it's... Because it's not. It's got some...
Well, it's not low-tech. In fact, it's the only naturally... this is a fact. I'm doing a fact.
Lexus.
It's the only naturally aspirated V8 in the world that can run on two different cycles. It runs on an Atkinson cycle at low speed, which is the same way that a Prius petrol engine operates, so that's a really fuel-efficient way, and then it reverts to a normal Otto cycle at higher speed. And that's quite a unique piece of technology, and it does help the fuel efficiency of the engine, if you care about such things when you're buying a muscle coupe.
I would argue most people who are buying those sorts of cars really don't too much.
But I mean, the F version of the RC Coupe is quite thoroughly redeveloped, like the Germans do. It's quite an expensive car. It's $159,900 in standard form.
But in that regard, it's still actually cheaper than the cars that sort of up against, like the BMW M3.
Slightly, So it's a 5-litre V8, 351 kilowatts, 550 newton metres. So that's pretty decent numbers, isn't it?
Pretty respectable.
It does 0 to 100 in 4.4 seconds, so that's a pretty quick car. It's certainly almost as quick as the likes of an M3, although an M3 is a six-cylinder, isn't it?
It is
so
now.
We shouldn't be talking about that in this podcast.
No.
You can also get a carbon edition of the RCF, which has got like carbon fibre bonnet and what have you. It's quite an outrageous looking
it's
thing.
Quite over the top.
That's $175,000 if you just want to be stupid. What do we think of the RCF? It's a controversial car. I think it's another one that doesn't necessarily sound as good as it could.
No, it's a bit of an odd sound.
I think it's artificially enhanced
the
sound.
It could be, but they haven't done it very well if that's the case. It sounds a bit sort of flat and odd. It's an odd one because it's a car that I really, really wanted to like and really, really thought I would love, but it left me feeling a bit...
It's a really good car. I've been quite lucky. I've driven it on the track twice.
Yes, that would
I went to
help.
The launch in the US, actually, at a private racetrack. And I've also driven it at Highlands Park down in Cromwell in New Zealand. And it is a great car on the track.
Yeah.
So I think, and that's, you know, F. The F in Lexus F is named after Mount Fuji Speedway. So these cars are all about track driving. You know, that's the idea, that you can take it on the track, and it is a great car on the track. It's also a really nice road car, but it just doesn't quite sort of have the fizz that you might be expecting from a car like that.
I would hesitate to
call it a muscle car, actually.
Yeah, it's fast and it's loud and it's quite fun, but it's I don't know, there's just something sort of missing from it that doesn't quite...
There is, it's just a little bit too safe, I think.
I think so.
And that's a shame, because there's a lot of technology in it. I mean, one of the options you can get is a torque vectoring differential, which is a very high-tech piece of kit. Can actively put power to the rear wheels when you're going through turns. You can even set it to different things. You can set the torque vectoring for slalom or for race or whatever. So, in that respect, there's plenty of stuff to play with. time
absolutely.
In the car.
Absolutely, and it's typically Lexus. I mean, it's beautifully built.
I personally think it looks really cool.
I think it looks fantastic too. Only real criticism I had about the interior was it kind of felt like it was a generation behind the rest of the range.
A lot of the equipment is not quite up with the very latest of the European. Even little things like the adaptive cruise control, you know, it's just not nearly as sophisticated as you get from a Mercedes-Benz or a BMW. So, a little disappointing. But having said that, I think the quality of the thing is just out of this world.
It's sensational.
It's a really appealing car, but perhaps not the mad V8 that it would like you to think it is.
No. I don't. It's a shame. It was a car that I sort of finished with and thought, okay.
And sort of moving from that, in a similar sort of genre, a car that looks quite low-key, actually, but is quite mad when you drive it, and that's the Mercedes C63S.
Absolutely.
Which, again, I've been lucky enough to drive. The car is not quite here yet in New Zealand, but I did go to Portugal to drive it earlier this year. And we did quite a bit of road driving on motorways there, which are actually toll roads, and it's quite a depressed area, obviously, and not many people are willing to pay to drive on toll roads, so it's basically the motorways are your own private racetrack, say no more. But we did actually go to a racetrack as well. We went to the Algarve International Circuit, which is quite a well-known track. So C63, all new generation car, really significant for one very important reason. It's got the brand new V8 engine, which is going to power a whole range of AMG vehicles. They've downsized. The old engine was a 5.5 bi-turbo V8. This new one is a 4-litre bi-turbo V8, but it's even more powerful.
Funny how they do that, isn't it? Make it smaller, more powerful.
Yeah, and in fact, the last of the C63s, the previous generation, they didn't even have that 5.5. They had the 6.2, didn't they?
Yes.
That was a naturally aspirated engine.
Yes, and which was a sensational engine.
That sounded awesome.
Yeah, that was incredible.
To be perfectly honest, I don't know if the new 4-litre V8 sounds quite as muscular as the old 6.2, but it's just so much more talented. It's got more power. Yeah. It's substantially more fuel efficient.
Well, one thing that Mercedes have always done very well, and they are very conscious of, is they do make their cars sound fantastic.
They do. They're another company that's really committed to V8s, a bit like Lexus F, I guess.
Yes.
They do make smaller engines. I mean, AMG do that completely mad 2-litre one that's in the A45 AMG, and that's just outrageous.
Yeah.
They're very proud of it, actually, and rightly so. So we only get the S version of that car.
Same as the E63, isn't it?
Similar concept, yeah.
There too. They don't bother with the lesser versions in New Zealand.
No, everyone tends to want the good ones.
Absolutely.
So that makes 375 kilowatts and 700 newton meters of torque. So it's got a 7-speed automatic gearbox. So that's a lot of grunt. Another thing they're very proud of, and this is a bit of a swipe at BMW, I think, very proud of the fact that there's no artificial sound enhancement. Because what's becoming really common with performance cars these days is with drive-by noise regulations and sort of pressure for car makers to be a bit less antisocial than they have been in the past, there's a lot of artificial sound piped into the cabin in performance cars, which you don't hear from the outside.
Yes. This car we're driving.
Does
it have that?
Hang on, just let me check. No, it doesn't.
No,
yeah, so Mercedes-Benz very proud of the fact that the sound in the C63 is all natural. There's no artificial stuff. Because, of course, its great rival is the BMW M3 M4.
Absolutely,
which is downsized to a Turbo 6, but also has a lot of artificial noise piped into the cabin.
Yes.
So it's like two fingers to BMW.
It is a wee one, isn't it?
I'm deeply impressed by the C63. It's just a fantastic car. I don't know if it's quite as nimble as the BMW on the track.
Okay.
I think the BMW is still more of a dancer. The C63 is still... It's got a lot of finesse, but it's still more of a muscle car, which I guess is what people like.
Well, that's what they've always traditionally been. I mean, apart from the last M3 that was a V8, BMWs have sort of always traditionally been a little bit more...
Yeah,
sort of a race-tuned six and a bit nimbler, whereas the AMG cars are just being big sledgehammers with huge engines.
Having said that, the previous C63 was probably the first first AMG vehicle that had real sort of chassis finesse.
Yeah.
And I've taken that a bit further with this one. It is a great car to drive in the corners. You know, I'm not saying it's a straight line machine by any stretch of the imagination. So the gap is closing between those two, but at heart they are a V8 company and they like the big noise and they like the big performance. Quite a subtle looking car though. We'll put a picture up on the website. You know, you look at it, it doesn't sort of leap out at you.
No, and that's again, that's sort of an AMG thing, isn't it? Too though they do keep them relatively subtle.
Yeah, well, it's a German thing, isn't it?
It is. Some they aspects. Like that.
So I mean, that's kind of a car that's in the premium sector. It's $164,900 for the C63S. So again, you could argue that's quite a bit of car for that money. It's a really well equipped car, and you know, fantastic, an iconic model, really.
Absolutely.
There'll be a lot of people waiting for that car to get to New Zealand. I think it's going to be here sort of mid-year. So look forward to having another go of that sitting on the correct side of the car.
Well, I look forward to having a go in the first place.
you and your Hellcat.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, that's a car in the premium sector, but you've sort of gone one up, haven't you, for the premium V8s?
A wee bit, yeah. As mentioned at the last podcast, I recently spent a day out at Hampton Downs driving the Maserati range.
And Hampton Downs is a great circuit for road cars, isn't it?
It is, yes.
It's got a lot of tight little corners, a lot of elevation.
It goes actually up and does down. Suit a road car really well.
Yeah.
Actually, it's probably more fun in a less powerful road car, to be honest.
Yes.
You have a lot of fun around it there. But that said, the Maserati still... what actually staggered me most about it was the difference between all of them.
So which ones did you drive?
Which one? Well, we drove basically the entire range. We had the Ghibli, which we won't talk about because it's not a V8.
So that's the sort of, even though we're not talking about it, now that you've mentioned it, that's like the smaller Maserati. It's sort of like a BMW 5 Series size, isn't it?
Yep. And it's a very cool car. It's got a V6. It sounds a bit like a V8, to be honest.
But it doesn't deserve to be on here because it's missing a couple of cylinders.
Exactly, exactly. There were also the Gran Turismo and the Gran Coupe.
Okay, so they're
the Cabrio, rather. Sorry.
The big two-door.
I got that wrong, the big two-door.
Yeah.
Which were actually surprisingly soft on the track.
Yeah.
Which is probably not that surprising.
They are kind of luxury coupes, though, aren't they? And they do, in the past, Maserati have done models like the MC Stradale, which I have driven, which are a lot harder and more focused.
Absolutely.
And that's sort of your race version, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So these are sort of luxury road cars.
Yeah, and then we also had the Quattroporte, and its various guises, but the...
So what was that like on the track? Because I've driven the odd Quattroporte, and it's a really striking car, but it's a big luxury sedan, isn't it? It's like a BMW 7 Series or an Audi A8.
Well, it was quite telling that probably the one I enjoyed the most on the track out there all day was actually a Quattroporte. It was the GTS, which is...
So
like
is there something wrong with you?
It was actually the firmest car.
Yeah.
It had the best suspension, it had the best brakes.
So which iteration of the Quattroporte did you drive? You drove the GTS, didn't you?
Drove the GTS, yeah. That's what I'm saying. That's the one I like the most. That's actually, we drove others as well. Diesel.
Was it a V8 diesel?
No, it's a six-cylinder diesel.
Don't bring that around here, thank you.
No, we won't mention that. Anyway, the surprise was that the GTS was the probably the better one on the track. It had all the upgraded brakes and suspension gear, and it was a lot of fun, but still feels like it's overtired, like it does on the road.
Yeah.
It just feels like the rubber's too massive.
Yeah.
And it really sort of almost bullies the car around the track. It's
so Italian though, isn't it?
It is.
They've obviously...
Oh, it's very...
I mean, it is a bit... It's a luxury sedan.
Yeah.
It's like a businessman's express.
It has no right
just,
to do that.
They can't resist, can they? Just making
just
it ridiculous.
Make it silly.
Yeah.
And it is. It sounds fantastic. I mean, as a Maserati should. They all sounded fantastic, except maybe the diesel.
I actually reckon the Quattroporte has become a lot more solid feeling since the company's become part of Fiat Chrysler.
Yeah.
You know, the switchgear is not fragile anymore, and it's got electronic systems from Chrysler with those, you know, the Uconnect touchscreen and what have you. It's just a much better car.
It is a nicer car. I really loved the last generation Quattroporte.
Yes.
But
you wouldn't want to own one.
No.
You'd be worried about what was going to fall off.
This is one that you might...
Yeah.
Possibly, if you're a bit different, want to own.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun. And like I said, the most telling thing was that the Quattroporte was the best on the track. But they did actually, on the same day, launch what was going to be called the Gran Turismo Trofeo.
Ooh. It's a special name.
But they got told they weren't allowed to call it that.
That doesn't surprise me.
It was going to be a New Zealand and Australia model, but they got slapped on the wrist from them from head office.
They thought they were too far away for anybody to notice.
They did. And
excuse me, I'm going to overtake a Corolla now.
Oh,
beautiful.
Lucky we've got four-wheel drive.
I would like to assure the listeners that we are travelling at a completely legal speed, by the way. I'm doing 84 kilometres an hour at the moment, so we
just
are
doesn't sound like
we are driving safely. We're just enjoying the engine
very
road.
Sensible.
Yeah. Sorry, do carry on with your Maserati story.
Yeah, that's right. Anyway, the upshot is they're now going to call it the MC Sportline. Which doesn't quite sound the same.
No.
But it's basically a slightly sharpened up version of the Gran Turismo, so...
That's a little bit cheeky too, calling it an MC, because that's Maserati Corsa. That's like the racing cars.
It's, you know, it's got lighter bits and pieces here and there, and it's sort of a wee bit racier, but it's...
Yeah, but it's not really.
No.
Yeah. I can actually, I can go one up. I sort of led you into this premium sort of tit for tat. I can go one up. I've also been driving the Mercedes S63 AMG Coupe.
Surely that is every bit as ridiculous as a large Italian luxury sedan on a racetrack.
Well, just to tell you, well, I haven't driven it on a racetrack, obviously. I would like to say, just two fingers to your Hellcat, this car actually produces 900 newton metres of torque. That is ridiculous.
That is absolutely
so sick. Being an S63 Coupe, it is the flagship of the S-Class range, so it's... As things tend to go, coupes are generally more expensive and prestigious than sedans, just because they're a bit more exclusive. The thing that's surprising about this car is it is very, very different from the S-Class sedan. And it's the first time we've had an S-Class coupe. The previous version of this car was called the CL. So what Mercedes-Benz are doing is they're changing around all their naming, and they're aligning each range of models with the car that they sort of are based on. So in this case, it's the S-Class.
Yeah.
So it's an S-Class coupe.
Yeah.
In the same way that the GL, the big off-roader, that's going to be called a GLS.
GLS.
Because it aligns with the S-Class.
The S-Class,
So it's getting a bit confusing.
I think eventually, theoretically, it should make sense, but...
I'm not so sure. They don't always think these things
through. No, they don't. They change their mind halfway through.
The other interesting thing is... This is, I would think, the very last Mercedes-Benz AMG vehicle that will be launched. Because from now on, including the C63 we were just talking about, vehicles that are part of the proper AMG family are going to be called Mercedes-AMG.
Right.
So it's a Mercedes-AMG C63, but this vehicle is a Mercedes-Benz AMG S63. You know, saying that out loud, it just sounds boring. I thought it was quite interesting. But they're changing everything around. So this, the S63, it's got the 5.5 litre bi-turbo engine, so it hasn't got the new generation V8. It's also one of the last cars to get that old V8. Having said that, they've cranked the power right up. It's 430 kilowatts, and as I said, 900 newton metres. It is a phenomenally fast car. It is also a very luxurious car. And in fact, they sort of pitch it as a luxury car.
Does that mean... It doesn't go around corners terribly well.
I'm glad you asked. It does go around corners extremely well for a very good reason. It's got magic suspension. It's got cameras fitted in front. Now, that's not unusual. Lots of cars have cameras fitted in front. Gives you sort of access to a whole range of functions like lane departure warning and what have you. But this car has got something called magic body control. Now, all S-Class V8 models have this magic body control. The camera reads the road ahead and it prepares the suspension for what's coming up. So obviously it's, you know, supposed to be ready for a bump before it happens, or ready for, you know, an undulation or a change in road surface before it happens. S-Class Coupe goes one step further. It's got something called curve tilting function. Now this is something you switch on. So you go through the various cycles of comfort, sport, what have you. This is curve tilting function, and what it does is it props the outside of the car up by up to, I think it's 2.65 degrees, and that means it leans into the corners like a motorbike. And you might think 2.65 degrees is not a lot, but you really notice it, and it is an eerie feeling.
Yeah.
And
I might just go back to your like a motorbike thing there, like an extraordinarily large motorbike.
like a 2-ton motorbike. With Swarovski crystal headlights.
Yes, don't forget that.
So, yeah, a really technologically really interesting car, yeah. But a bit of an oddity in the AMG range because Mercedes-Benz are very firm on this being a luxury vehicle, which seems out of character with AMG.
Yeah.
And that's really borne through in the engine note, actually. It's another V8. I think you can tell it's a V8. It's got a bit of a growl to it. But it's very subdued for an AMG
car.
And you know that's quite deliberate because every other AMG Mercedes sounds absolutely nuts.
Yeah,
interesting car.
I noticed you didn't touch on the press car's choice of a white leather interior.
Because it caused me a lot of anxiety. So the entire interior of the car was white. Steering wheel, dashboard, carpet, seats. I have two children. Very stressful. I actually turned all the mats upside down, so I didn't.
Just hearing you describe it, it sounds appalling, and it actually really is awful. But it's a lovely interior.
It is a beautiful interior.
But don't get it in white.
No, white wouldn't be my first choice.
Not at all.
I think they specified the press car that way because they thought it would look great in photographs, and it does actually.
Yes.
It photographs really well.
Yeah.
One thing I haven't mentioned is the price. It's quite expensive.
It is, in fact, I was just looking at it, the most expensive car we are talking about.
I think so. It's $350,000, and rest assured, there are options. You could add more. And in fact, I said it was the flagship of the range. It's not actually the most expensive S-Class coupe, though. There is an S65 AMG,
yes.
Which is the V12.
The V12, yeah.
V12 is completely different in character to V8, so we won't go there.
No. It's even more of a luxury car, isn't it?
It is, and it's even more ridiculously expensive, actually.
And I don't think it's powerful, or is it...
No.
Insanely more powerful.
You're incorrect.
It is more powerful. Okay, it is. That's all right.
It has 1,000 newton meters of torque, which is why I think probably this S63 has been deliberately restrained to 900.
Sure,
you've got to leave the top one somewhere to go. Probably any more, and the power would just spin uselessly away anyway. Yeah, you probably wouldn't actually get any forward motion.
I think those 1,000 newton meter ones, they're all actually limited to that anyway, aren't they?
They are.
They're producing a lot more than that. But anyway.
Yeah,
it's a V12. We're not talking about V12.
Incredible car, quite an experience to drive it. A little bit of an oddity, I suppose, but just amazing. You know, if you see one on the road, you'd know it. It looks really, really different to an S-Class sedan.
And actually, just some of the lines on it look very sort of concept car-ish, in that they're quite adventurous for Mercedes and.
They are.
For Mercedes getting, to put on a road car.
For a company with a reputation for being quite conservative, they are actually getting very adventurous with their styling.
So
we applaud that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, from an oddity to something just incredibly unlikely, I've also been driving something which actually takes us a little bit closer to the car we're in.
A little bit.
We're not there yet.
No, we're not there yet, but we'll get there.
But I've been driving the new BMW X5 M and X6 M.
The second generations of cars they said they'd never make.
That's right.
I like it.
So this is where it gets confusing because BMW, I think, very irresponsible with their M badges.
They have been. Yes.
BMW Motorsport is their high performance division. They make wonderful cars, M3, M5, M6, just fantastic vehicles. We love them. But they also have other things with M badges on them. They have M Performance, which is sort of one tier down.
Yeah.
So they're not cars that are developed by M, but they're sort of enhanced by M.
Yeah.
And then they do things called M Sport, which are just sort of dress-up packages.
Badges
which
and spoilers and
bodyguards. Personally find offensive.
Yeah.
But,
and leads to people who buy Japanese import M-kitted 318 coupes.
And they say, I drive an M3.
Yeah.
No, you don't. Anyway, I digress. So the reason why these are unlikely vehicles is that they are absolutely products of BMW Motorsport. They are genuine M vehicles, despite being massive SUVs. And in fact, back when they were launched, these cars were the first ever M cars to have automatic transmissions, the first ever M cars to have four-wheel drive, and the first ever M cars to be SUVs. So basically they ran the risk of ruining the reputation of M.
Yeah.
They seem to have been quite popular regardless because they've done a second generation of both of them.
Well, fortunately, they did make them utterly mental.
Oh, they're crazy.
So they're just
crazy cars.
Completely, insanely powerful. They handle just like nothing that
they
should.
Well, like sports cars.
I mean, it's impossible, but they do it.
So they are both V8s. X5 obviously is the sort of square shape SUV. X6 is the coupe style, very controversial shape, which we all laughed at when it came out a few years ago, but they've just sold so many of them.
Absolutely.
They've sold 250,000 X6s globally. Good. It's been a phenomenally successful car. So they've done a second generation one, and in fact Mercedes-Benz have copied it, haven't they?
Yes,
they've done something called a GLE coupe, which is exactly the same thing.
Yep.
So kudos to BMW. You knew your customers. We didn't.
It's still silly looking, though.
It is. The new one's a bit less silly.
Yes, a bit less. And to give them credit there, I've always said that the sillier the engine they put in it, the better that car gets. So,
which brings us nicely to the M version.
Exactly.
BMW M does not do things by halves.
No.
So these vehicles have been redeveloped so much, they're basically new cars. They've both got a brand new 4.4-litre bi-turbo V8 engine. Makes a ridiculous amount of power, 423 kilowatts, 750 newton metres. That's fast.
That is.
They get to 100 k's an hour in 4.2 seconds.
Actually, can I just jump in there and say that the Hellcat, I forgot to mention before,
Sorry, we're finished with the Hellcat now. We're on
just
to my thing.
By way of comparison,
yes.
0 to 100 in 3.4 seconds.
Yeah, that's impressive.
That means that X5 and X6M are not that much slower.
No, well they're
massive SUVs.
Probably the more relevant comparison is that they are very, very close on the heels of an M3, which is sort of regarded as
right,
a purist BMW M car. So incredible vehicles, just monster power. They don't have the dual clutch gearbox that all the other M cars have, because BMW hasn't yet made a dual clutch gearbox that can handle 750 newton meters of torque. So it's got a conventional 8-speed automatic.
Right.
Which they say, oh, we've tuned it to make it perform like a DCT. Well, yeah, okay. It's it's good. It changes gears fast, but
it can't back up hills properly.
It's a good gearbox, but it can't. Theoretically, it can't be as good as a sort of an automated manual.
No.
But, you know, no complaints about the way it performs for sure. It's got every chassis aid you could possibly imagine. Comes on 21-inch wheels as standard. Good for off-roading. It's got, you name it, it's got it. It's got dynamic drive, which sort of locks the suspension shut and stops body roll when you go around corners. So regardless of what speed you're going around a corner, the car is just flat.
Right.
Because it's got the suspension system that kind of locks shut as soon as you turn into a corner. It's got adaptive the suspension as well, so you know you can set it to soft or firm or anything in between. It keeps the BMW M tradition of being ferociously complex to operate. You can choose individual settings for the engine, the steering, and the suspension. You can also, there's a further button where you can choose between three settings for the aggression of the gear changes.
Oh, yes.
So that's four different settings with three choices each, which you can mix and match. I don't know how many possible combinations that is, but it's a lot. So,
to their credit, they still give you all those programmable M buttons that you can.
They do. So you can set
your favourite settings, and
you can set the car up and have your favourite setting and just press the M button.
Yeah.
There's two. Yeah. As you say,
so
there's M1, M2.
Have a mental one and a slightly less mental one.
Yeah. So you know, really drove it in Australia, not on a track, on a public road. The thing about BMW M is so much of the credibility rests on their sort of track performance. And they really have engineered this thing to go on the track. Like, it's got special oil supply systems that stop it getting starved of oil under extreme acceleration and extreme cornering. It's got, you know, like a million cooling devices for the transmission in here. You can take one of these things on a track day and you could hammer it around a racetrack all day and it would be fine. You know, it's got massive brakes. It's just over-engineered to the max. It is ridiculous. I said to some of the BMW people when we were there, do people with these cars really take them on track days? And they said, well, no, of course not. You know, a BMW owner who wants to go on a track day has probably got an M3 in the garage.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, of course. But the thing about these cars is, in the same way that, you know, if you've got a Rolex watch, you might not necessarily be a Navy diver.
In fact, you probably aren't. There's a fairly good chance you're not.
But in your mind,
in your
might
mind,
be. And it's the same thing with these cars. It's just really important to the credibility of the M brand that you can take these cars on a track.
Yep, absolutely.
And, you know, believe me, they can do it. So, completely nonsensical vehicle, but just an amazing engineering achievement, and really quite silly. the other interesting thing about both of these cars is that BMW has done an about face on its policy on noise, because it's copped a lot of flack for having artificially generated noise in both the yes. M5, which is a V8,
yes,
and the M3, which is a 6.
Yes.
Both
to
of those.
Honest, I think they kind of went too far with the M3, and
they did.
What really?
It's a very artificial sound. The M3. It's loud but artificial.
Yeah.
People were most disappointed about the M5, I think, because they wanted to feel that V8 noise was genuine. So with the X5M and the X6M, there is no artificial sound whatsoever. It's all done with massive exhaust pipes and a big V8 engine, and it actually sounds fantastic. And it's not a deep rumble like this car. It's more of a... It's okay, Damien's clutching the dashboard now. Don't be frightened.
No, I'm okay.
It's not a deep, rumbly V8.
I'm driving a Hellcat in the rain.
Yeah, righto. it's not a deep, rumbly V8 like the car we're in now. It's actually quite a raspy sound. It's like a racing car.
Cool.
And it is very cool.
As it should be. It's an M car, after all.
And it plays both roles quite well. It can do that noise, but then if you drive it gently, it's actually quite docile. So,
I don't know if I'm entirely comfortable with the idea of BMW doing MSUVs, but at least they do them to the extreme.
Do you know who's really comfortable with the idea?
BMW?
Oh, BMW, looking at the bank account, and people in the United States who love big SUVs,
yes, that
and like
true.
Big SUVs that are very expensive and fast.
Well, that actually moves us nicely.
It does.
Into what we're in.
Yes, it's sort of in that ballpark, isn't it?
Very much so.
It's a special vehicle, actually. The car we're in is the only example of its type in the country at the moment.
It is.
So we're quite lucky. We've just been allowed to borrow it for a couple of days. It's a Range Rover Sport SVR. Now,
you didn't have that in mind at the start of this podcast.
So, Range Rover Sport, we all know. It's sort of the middle size Range Rover. It is, as the name suggests, the sportiest one. Still a big, capable off-roader, but good to drive. SVR is a new brand, and it's the product of a special tuning division. Now, this is an idea that is not unfamiliar.
It isn't. It's in fact...
In fact, you can't be in the premium car game unless you've got a separate tuning division. So
preferably with initials.
Yeah,
with
initials,
helps.
Yeah. So SVO is the name of the company, Special Vehicle Operations. It's part of Jaguar Land Rover, but it is, of course, separate, which is what all these companies say. we own them, but they're very separate. They do their own thing.
They've got a shed out the back.
They have got a shed out the back. The company was only started last year. So, still a relatively new thing. This is the first production car from SVO. And the reason why it's called SVR rather than SVO, there's a couple of reasons. One's the corporate reason, and I think the other's the real reason. The corporate reason is that SV, special vehicle, of course.
Yes.
R is the performance brand that's always attached to Jaguars and Land Rovers.
Yes.
And even on the badge, you get a little SV and then a nice big red R.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm gesticulating. Doing an R, an R shape.
I can see it, and yeah. No one else. But
so that's the corporate reason. And the other corporate reason is that special vehicle operations do more than just performance cars. They do all the luxury stuff as well. So they're sort of halfway between a sort of a BMW M and probably a Rolls-Royce bespoke or whatever they call that division.
Yeah.
So they've done other things like a super luxury long wheelbase version of the big Range Rover. This is their first series production car. The other thing they've done, which is quite interesting, is the Project 7, the sort of gentleman racer car based on the F-Type.
Oh, yes. Yes,
which has sort of got a little low windscreen and everything. Yeah, that's a very limited run car, though.
Yeah.
This is a proper,
proper production
car. The real reason why it's not called SVO, can you guess, Damien?
Could it be something to do with previous ownership?
I think so. Ford, of course, has a special vehicle operations, and I think SVO is quite a common brand on American Fords.
It is,
Yeah, there's Taurus SVOs and things. So.
They still use it to this day, and it was quite big in the 80s. Mustang SVOs when they were turboing everything.
Yeah, so I suspect, obviously, America's going to be a big market for this car, and I suspect if they launched it with an SVO badge on the grill, particularly as Ford used to own Jaguar Land Rover, I think you might get a big fat lawsuit.
It mightn't go down too well.
So,
this is a company that had a go at Ferrari for calling their Formula One car the F-150.
Correct, yes.
So it doesn't even matter if
it's
similar.
Passing off law. So anyway, about this car.
Yes, it's
very powerful.
It is extraordinarily powerful.
The standard sort of vehicle this is based upon is the Range Rover Sport 5-litre supercharged V8. So that's quite an extreme vehicle.
It's quite a noisy vehicle too.
It's certainly
not a subtle machine.
So this one ups the ante a bit. Standard car's got 375 kilowatts. This one has got 405 kilowatts. And it's got 680 newton metres of torque, which in any other company would be extreme, but we've just been talking about a 750 newton metre BMW, haven't we?
Which, I mean, I haven't driven the BMWs, but I have driven the previous ones, and
you've driven the Hellcat.
Did
you mention that?
Yeah, I'll mention that again at some stage.
Yeah.
But this thing just feels completely mental.
It is bonkers.
It's just...
Yeah. The noise is relentless. It never shuts up. It's a very exciting car, but it's kind of stupid as well. There's actually a loud button for the exhaust, but if you switch it off, it's still loud.
It doesn't make it much quieter.
So that's one change for this car. The transmission's been recalibrated to give much faster gear changes. It's an 8-speed auto. There's been some strengthening and some modification in the suspension. They've done a bit of work on the differential at the back, I think, to make it a little bit more tail happy, if that's possible in a big SUV, and I think we've both learnt that it is.
It seemed to be, yes.
So it's all about, it's this idea again of a hyper-performance SUV in a similar vein to the X5M, I suppose.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it doesn't actually make sense, but it is, I mean, the result is quite remarkable.
But you know what?
Remarkable.
If cars had to make sense, then we'd be out of a job,
exactly.
Probably, because people wouldn't be passionate about
them.
So this, as I said, this is the only one in New Zealand at the moment. There are seven more on the way. They're all sold, and that's your lot for this year. So very exclusive.
So if
vehicle.
You're listening to this thinking, oh, I wouldn't mind one of them, you're out of luck.
You're out of luck. Oh, plus it's $228,000.
Well, there is that.
Really, an incredible vehicle. The interesting thing about it is that it has a strange relation. And it's something else in the Jaguar Land Rover family. The V8 engine in this state of tune is actually the same as it is in the Jaguar Coupe F-Type R. So the very, very top F-Type Coupe, which
you
is called the R.
You weren't expecting that, were you?
No.
You were thinking XJ or...
Yeah, it's probably the only car I can think that's actually louder than this one.
Yes.
And that's probably just because the cabin is a bit bigger in this car and it's not resonating quite as much. And the other interesting thing is Jaguar has just launched an all-wheel drive version of the Coupe R. So they are actually quite closely related when you think about it. They've got a lot in common.
They have. Yeah. And it wouldn't be too much of a leap to believe that Jaguar four-wheel drive system would be quite closely related.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think they've openly acknowledged that. They've said they've used expertise from Land Rover to create that all-wheel drive F-Type. So,
by which they mean, give us that. We want to chuck it in this. So,
famous relations. So, I mean, this is a really exclusive vehicle. It's a really exciting vehicle. What does surprise me a little bit about it is that the engineering job is probably not quite as comprehensive as I would have expected for something that's sort of the first car out of the ranks for
SVO. It's almost like they've taken a bit of a low-key,
Nothing low-key about a Range Rover Sport.
In engineering terms, they haven't tried to sort of overreach and go, but...
I think they've played it safe.
They have played it safe. They've taken existing parts and...
They know what works. Yeah. They know that their customers like loud engines. They know they like, big V8s. They know that a car like this has got to be able to do big drifts on a racetrack, as ridiculous as that sounds. So they've played it safe. They've ticked all the boxes and actually done a pretty good job.
Absolutely.
I don't think it has the sophistication of an X5M, to be honest.
No, well, and the one thing that would probably be great about it is that it never actually seems to relax.
No.
It's always noisy. It's
and that's the same
angry.
For all of those Jaguar cars as well, the V8s.
Yeah.
The F-Type V8 is the same. It's just never quietens down. It's always roaring. Yeah. It's always popping and crackling. Great fun if you're in the mood for it.
Absolutely.
Might get a bit tiresome if you're driving it all the time.
If you make a habit of going out too early in the morning and coming home late at night, the neighbours will hate you with a passion.
Well, I mean, I've had this, both this vehicle and the F-Type V8, actually, I've had at home and I've had early morning starts, and I have gritted my teeth starting it up because I thought, I really hope the neighbours don't think that I'm being a smart ass. Because when you start them up...
It gives a big rip.
It does. It's got show-off mode.
Yeah.
When you start it up, it goes...
Yeah.
And it's like, yep, don't need that. But I am staggered by the balance and grip and composure of this Range Rover for such a big vehicle. I mean, it's a lot lighter than the old Range Rover Sport, but the old Range Rover Sport, you know, weighed as much as a supertanker.
Exactly.
This is still, you know, a 2-ton vehicle, and it just goes like stink. 0 to 100, 4.7 seconds.
That's just fast. Silly.
And it actually feels faster because it's so loud.
It does, it feels ferociously fast. It actually probably feels slightly faster than that, to be honest.
Yeah, it does.
Just the drama of it, the noise and the sort of settling back on the suspension and roars off. And
they haven't, you know, they haven't done a whole lot to the car in terms of styling. It's got different bumpers and what have you, and a few detail changes.
It's quite subtle, if you could accuse it.
Yeah.
You know, massive white Range Rover of being subtle. It is.
We are sitting in very nice SVR logoed racing seats.
Yes.
Which they're a nice touch. And again, slightly ludicrous to be sitting in a racing style bucket.
Yes.
18 feet off the ground in a Range Rover. Could you go off road? Theoretically. It's got all the stuff in it, it's got terrain response.
I would suggest the only time that one of these is going to go off road is if the owner cocks up a corner. That's what it's going to be.
Yeah. Do you take your Range Rover SVR off-road? Well, not on purpose. It is easy to get carried away in it.
Yes.
And it's a sort of vehicle I'll be quite glad to give back, actually, because it's just, it brings out the worst.
It does.
You've probably heard that on the soundtrack quite a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, I mean, that's probably a good note to end on.
I think so. That was our V8 special from a V8.
Yeah.
A very special V8.
We'll be back to being a bit more sensible next time. We'll bring you some news and some road tests. But we've just enjoyed this trip down V8 lane. Hope you have too.
Indeed. Thank you very much.
Bye.
See you.
The New Zealand Motoring Podcast. Brought to you by podcasts.co.nz.